Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, HRN has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And you know the political saying, as goes Ohio, so goes the nation, or whichever state is the current bellwether state for that election. But for the popularity of ethnic foods, it's whatever is in New York, so goes the nation, with a few exceptions, I'm sure. Just think bagels, lox, pastrami on rye. These are just a couple of the more popular Jewish items that have become synonymous with New York food. Foods that were brought by Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe to New York have become some of the most iconic foods associated with New York City. And their popularity is spread across the country and are often referred to as New York food. Author June Hirsch joins me today to discuss the history of many of these specialties, which she's written about in her book, Iconic New York Jewish Food. June Hirsch, a New Yorker, is a food writer and the author of 5 books, 4 of which focus on food. Her first book is Recipes Remembered, A Celebration of Survival. And her latest book is Iconic New York Jewish Food, A History and Guide with Recipes, in which she continues her passion for preserving food memory and sharing the stories of Jewish immigrants as they influenced and imprinted their cuisine on the foodways of this country. Welcome, June.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me. I should have had you write the preface to the book because you gave such a wonderful, succinct overview of what the book is really about. I applaud you for that. Thank you.
Well, I have been reading a lot of reviews of the book and your book, and it is, for the slim copy that it is, folks, let me tell you, this book is chock full of incredible information, background, history, as I said, recipes, but just fun stories, great stories and touching stories. And June, I have to say, you have been researching and documenting the foods of Jewish immigrants for years now. Your first book, Recipes Remembered, and that's the survivors of the Holocaust and getting writing down a lot of their recipes and foods. And now this book, what inspired these to continue this pursuit?
Well, you know, it's so interesting because when I first started working on Recipes Remembered, A Celebration of Survival, it was, I'm going to say, a small project that I did, having sold our family business. We were at a crossroads. My sister so wisely said to me, we did well, now let's do good. And I was trying to find what my good would be. What was that path for me? And I had a real passion for writing, and I love to cook. And at the time, we were supportive and still are of the Museum of Jewish Heritage in New York City. And I proposed to them that I would write a book featuring the stories and the recipes of Holocaust survivors. And while the two seem so disparate, it came together really seamlessly because this book is a celebration of the heritage that the survivor community has lovingly preserved for us, and all that they endured and how they went from tragedy to triumph. And a large component of it are the foods that they brought forward. And so in speaking to that community, I really got literally a taste of what Jewish history, the flavors of Jewish history, what really are the components, the what I like to call the why to the what. Why do we eat what we eat in mm-hmm. Jewish culture? Because unlike other groups or ethnicities or cultures or religions, we don't come from just one place. We come from every place. And so we bring together this amalgam of food stories. And that's what I strive to do in Recipes Remembered. And that's what I hope I accomplish in telling the food stories of this community of Holocaust survivors.
Mm-hmm. And then with, you know, you've continued now with the iconic Jewish foods.
Exactly, because what really happened in between is I wrote several other books, one focusing on kosher meat and poultry. I admittedly am not kosher, but I was really enamored in the mindfulness and the respect that the kosher household shows to tradition. And so I wrote a book on kosher meat and poultry. I did another book on Holocaust survivors. I kind of got off track a little bit with a book on yogurt's history. But what that did for me, even though it was kind of off brand and off topic, it told me that my true passion is telling the history and the context of food. And yogurt had a very rich and long history, and that brought me back to my roots. And so I proposed to this publisher, The History Press, that I do another book that delves into the historical backstory of Jewish food. And as a New Yorker, that just naturally brought me to this subject matter.
Well, and you did it very well, I must say.
Thank you. I don't think anyone has enjoyed doing homework as much as I did. I overwhelmed anyone who I spoke to, or certainly my husband, with little tidbits and stories and uncovered little unknown or little known facts and figures that truly delighted me. And I was hopeful that that would come through in the writing, and that that would be the takeaway. And all my puns are very much intended, as the Times pointed out. I think Florence Fabricant invented a word, punacious, to describe the plethora of puns that I apparently use. But the takeaway from this book is that food just has this fabulous story to tell. And if you just open yourself up to hearing the backstories, the foods become even more flavorful, because the context gives them just such rich, you know, rich backstories. And that's right. What makes the food important. It's not the ingredients. It's right. The story the food tells.
Absolutely. Well, and I have to add that this book is, as well as your other book, the Recipes Remembered book, is a charitable project as well, with a portion of the proceeds going to worthwhile organizations.
Yes, and that's a very important component to me. That mm-hmm. was part of the "We did well, now let's do good." And Recipes Remembered benefited, and at this point we've sold well over 20,000 copies. All of the proceeds have gone to charitable organizations. Some has gone to reprint the books, because we will never allow that book to be out of circulation. And I am very proud that iconic New York Jewish food is benefiting the Met Council, which is the largest food pantry. It's probably the best kept secret in New York, but it is the largest food pantry, not just of kosher food, but of halal food. And it is providing a dignified solution to food insecurity all across the country, and very specifically in food pantries in New York. It's an amazing organization that is really serving a tremendous need, and I'm thrilled to be sharing proceeds with them.
That's great. That's terrific. When I said I had been reading a lot of different articles and reviews about you and about the book, and there was one journalist, and I love what she wrote. She said, "The iconic Jewish foods," about the title of the play on the title of the book, "the iconic Jewish foods that make New York, New York." And yeah, so obviously we would say maybe Jewish foods are rooted in New York, but it's really not easy to define. Tell us a little bit about that, the fact that Jewish foods make New York, or so, make New York, New York, or make New York what it, you know, the, what the food scene that it is.
And I think they have definitely, and you use the word imprinted at the beginning of the conversation, and the book was almost titled Iconic New York Food That Happens to Be Jewish.
Yeah.
Because it could be written both ways. Are these New York foods that are rooted in the Jewish culinary experience, or are these Jewish foods that made their way to New York and embedded themselves in New York food ways? And the answer is yes, it is both of those things. When the Jewish immigrants came over, primarily in the late 1800s through about 1924 was when the last wave really settled in. And of course, it continues to be an influx from different areas. And but the Eastern European influxes were during that period of time in these two great waves. And when they came, they didn't come here by choice. You know, very rarely do Jewish people end up where they wanted to be. Generally, we end up by circumstance or happen chance, and almost never by a planned move. So these Eastern European immigrants basically had little left for them where they lived, and they came to America. And what did they know? Well, they knew how to be merchants, but what's so interesting is they knew how to be merchants of pushcarts, because there were rules in Europe, in the area that is generally called the Pale of Settlement, which involves Eastern Europe and what's the Ukraine now and Poland and those regions. And Jewish people were not allowed by law to have stationary businesses. So they found a loophole. And I found that Jewish immigrants were really good at finding loopholes. They found a loophole. They put a wheel on a cart, and they now had a kiosk that could move. And therefore, they got around that rule, and they were allowed to conduct business. Hmm. And so when they came to New York, that's why they flooded the streets of New York with pushcarts. It was something that they brought forward with them from their experiences in what I guess we can really call the old country. And that began their foray into the food world, because at the same time of wanting to assimilate, they also desperately wanted to hold on to their culture. And they walked a very fine line. It wasn't easy. And if you picture the Lower East Side where so many of them settled, they, you know, their community, the Jewish community, butted up right next to the Chinese immigrant community and the Italian immigrant community. And so you had this common shared experience of being new people in a new place who also wanted to cling to the familiar.
Right.
And so these pushcarts were an opportunity for them to begin selling the foods that they were comfortable with, and also selling some of the ritual items that they needed to remain observant Jews in a place now where they were allowed to be observant Jews. So not only did they sell pickles and herring, but they also sold prayer shawls and prayer books. And so the pushcarts became really the central focus of commerce, not just for Jewish people, for all immigrants, but Jewish people really found their niche in doing this. And so now right. You had these carts that were filling the streets and introducing the other immigrant groups to these foods. I laugh sometimes and I say Jewish people were in a pickle and had a smoking habit, because so many of our foods were either pickled or smoked. And those were new foods for so many of these groups.
Right. You know, it's interesting because you say they you know were came with so many other immigrants, and talk about the Lower East Side brings to mind the Tenement Museum, mm-hmm. where you'll be speaking, but also Jane Ziegelman's book 97 Orchard.
Yes, which I drew on a lot because yeah. It really tells the stories of not just Jewish immigrants but all immigrants.
All of them. But they were. It's interesting because you say pickled and smoked, and so many of these foods that immigrants brought, the Germans with their cabbage and the Italians mm-hmm. with their pasta. And the odors, you know, there was, they were told not to eat their foods and to stop making their foods. But everyone wants their own food. They bring their foods because it's a comfort to them, right?
That's correct.
The immigrants. And so many of these foods that have become iconic that you have pointed out, which we'll talk about now, are, I consider like comfort food, you know, it really is to anyone. It's a comfort food, you know?
Absolutely. You know, I often say that long before we knew about organic cooking or we knew about farm to table and we had all of those terms coined, immigrants, that's the way they ate. If it grew in the ground and it could hold in their cellar, I learned that from Recipes Remembered, that there's a reason why there were so many recipes built on cabbage and potatoes and celery root and turnips. These were the foods that were familiar and common, and they were affordable. Now you come to America and all of a sudden you have these foods that you had experiences with back in your original country, and now they're available to you easily, and they're available affordably. You know, Jewish people didn't eat lox and bagels in Poland. Number one, the combination didn't exist. Mm-hmm. And number two, smoked salmon, lox as it was known at the time, because it was really cured and not smoked. That's the distinction. But that food was not available to the average Jewish shtetl, you know, villager. That was too expensive. They ate pickled herring. Herring was food of the people. And so you look at somebody like the owner of Russ and Daughters, who started out as a herring salesman from a pushcart.
Right.
And from that, he built a what we would call now a brick and mortar store and established a dynasty of, you know, appetizing, again, a word that Jewish people took from being an adjective to a noun. There was no such thing as an appetizing store before the Jewish immigrant experience. It just didn't exist.
I wanted to move into that about appetizing stores, appetizing carts, if you will, but they were stores now. And then the birth of the delicatessen, which has, you know, its roots in a couple different places, but appetizing for sure, as you mentioned. I want to talk about these, if you will, stores where people could get these foods. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, what I would say is that very often, and it's a common thread that runs through Jewish food going back thousands of years to the percentage of Jewish people who remain kosher, who identify with dietary laws. That's what actually helped establish the appetizing store, because now you had a group of foods that you could not mix with meat and other foods. So you needed, the Jewish community needed to develop a store that could sell herring, fish, cheese, cream cheese, foods that were now pickled in a cream sauce. And these were all foods that fall into the dairy category, or what I call the neutral category. Fish and herring and such are neutral. They can be eaten at any meal. It's interesting that the word appetizing actually evolved from the fact that many of these foods were appetizers at the Jewish meal, whether it was a Sabbath meal or a Tuesday night meal. They were the foods that they started with, because if you started with herring, you could then have either a meat or a dairy meal. It's neutral. It's like the Switzerland of food. And so when they came to America, you took that word, which is in Yiddish, Vorspeise, and it means appetizing, starter, to begin. And that's how the word appetizing really evolved and became into this actual phenomena that took place in New York City in the early 1900s, where stores were established that could sell just these foods. They also sold nuts, they sold candy, they sold halva. And they also, for some reason, and I don't really understand it, almost always sold dried mushrooms. You can still see them. If you go to the Lower East Side and you walk down the area where Russ and Daughters is on the Lower East Side, and it's a fascinating, you go into a Jewish food coma as you walk down the street, and you'll see that there are strings of dried mushrooms in the windows of most of these stores. That's why those stores developed.
Right. And the strings of those and the glass jars filled with them, things that I don't even pay attention that much to anymore because you just sort of take it for granted they're there. And that's interesting that you don't know why dried mushrooms. That's interesting.
Right. Yeah. Because it's evocative of the kiosks that they used to have. They would take a lot of the foods, bagels, for instance, and dried foods, and they would string them, and then they would hang them from the sides of the kiosk. I believe that we have a photo in the book that shows that they would just hang them off the side. It was just a way to utilize some additional display space. No different than, again, and you say you take it for granted, any New Yorker walks by a delicatessen, we are just used to seeing this stack behind the counter of canned goods that goes from almost floor to ceiling. Mm-hmm. You'd have to be a giraffe in order to get the item off the highest shelf. And that's just the way things were displayed. They use vertical, horizontal, every square inch is utilized because we came from a culture where we were confined to these small selling spaces and we had to make use of every square inch. And once that's in your mindset, it's almost in your DNA, you continue to do that even as you move forward and become more successful. So you could look at any of the delis today who are incredibly successful, from Zabar's and Barney Greengrass to Russ and Daughters, Katz's, they all have that display case, floor to ceiling.
That's great. And, you know, the delicatessen, as you say, it usually they would spring up because in New York real estate is so expensive too, is that in small spaces, whereas, you know, across the country, there are delicatessens, not that many, but there are. And, you know, we don't want them to fade away. We want to save those. But I was impressed to read something that I had not known about, that there was a magazine devoted to delicatessen and that the industry was actually regulated.
Yes, it was very regulated. And you know, what's interesting is that, and I think it's because it's part of the, if I can sound prideful in this regard, I think it's part of the Jewish intellect to take the written word very seriously and to be governed by rules and laws. It's the foundation. And that carried through everything. You look at, for instance, the bagel workers. They were one of the first and strongest unions, and they set the standard for unions throughout. They were socialist leaning, and they really valued the idea of having a set of rules and laws and standards by which to conform. And so you look at the delicatessen, and it followed that same pattern. They needed to have, and they wanted to have, a magazine, and it regulated how much you could sell a knish for, how much meat should be in a pastrami sandwich. And these were things that were truly dictated. Now, some of what was controlled within the delicatessen came from outside forces, and some of them could be viewed, I'm sure they were then and probably even more so now, as measures to almost be anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic in some ways, because they wanted to restrict what the delicatessen could and could not do. And so you look at the blue laws, which regulate what can be sold on a Sunday, because it is the day where many were governed by going to church in the morning. And so restaurants couldn't open until a certain hour. And in order to be a restaurant, you had to have tables. Well, because delicatessens were not opened for the most part on Saturday, the Jewish Sabbath, if they had had to conform to those blue laws, they wouldn't be open on Sunday either. And so the delicatessen industry was very closely regulated, and you needed to have a magazine and people who were going to stand up for you and say, no, No, the deli needs to be open on Sunday because they're not doing any business on Saturday. So here's what they need to do. Here's how they have to adapt. And again, finding loopholes, they put tables in and they disallowed the takeaway. And as long as the food was considered an entree and not just side dishes, they were allowed to be open on Sunday. And so they got around that. And the Delicatessen magazine helped them accomplish all of these ways to conduct business.
All right. Well, and that business, you know, was booming in New York in particular. And as it started to fade away, of course, it didn't fade away. But there was for a while that there seemed that the delicatessens were not thriving. I think we've moved past that, and they are there, and they are there to stay. In fact, there's, I think some are reintroducing it, such like the egg cream. Egg cream was starting to fade away. But now there are some luncheonettes and some small stores that are reintroducing them to, well, just introducing them to a younger generation who didn't know from an egg cream.
Correct. I use the expression funny, you don't look newish. And it's the phenomena of reinventing these classics and bringing them to a new generation. Mm-hmm. I look at somebody like Gomberg Seltzer. They call themselves the Brooklyn Boys. And they have been, I think, a third or maybe even a fourth generation seltzer family whose original ancestors delivered seltzer almost like the milkman would in cases, you know, with 10 bottles of seltzer of these beautifully colored glass bottles that came over from Czechoslovakia and Hungary. And they're iconic in their own right. And they now have these pop-ups, egg cream stations, and they are bringing the delicious taste of a freshly made egg cream, the old-fashioned way, out of a siphon bottle, to a new generation of egg cream drinkers. And you've got to have You Bet chocolate syrup if you want it to be an authentic New York egg cream. And you have to have three hands because one of them holds the glass, one of them spritzes a seltzer, and the third hand has to stir it as you go. So it's a three-ingredient drink, but it takes a little finesse to make it perfectly and get that really lovely head on it. But the egg cream is a good example. You have Peter Shelsky at Shelsky's in Brooklyn that is taking some of these sandwiches and whitefish and pickled lox, and it's turning it on its head. And I'm going to say, and they're not all necessarily kosher. Now, because
we're going to talk about some of those specific dishes before you go in through your list, because you've already named quite a few interesting ones I want to touch on.
Sure.
More deeply. So we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk specific foods.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Okay, we're back, and I am talking to June Hirsch, the author of Iconic New York Jewish Food, A History and Guide with Recipes. And June, without giving away everything that's in the book and just talking about the foods that we all know that somehow some became iconic and have traveled and endured, and some not. But there are certain foods that, you know, you ask somebody in the Midwest about pastrami, they wouldn't necessarily say pastrami on rye. They wouldn't necessarily identify as a Jewish food, but just identify it as a New York food. Mm-hmm. What makes certain foods become more iconic than others? You have any insights into that?
Yeah, I tend to think that those foods that became more iconic did so because of a couple of factors. One, I think they were marketed, and that was before we had TikTok and Instagram and all of these wonderful podcasts that can discuss these culinary adventures. But before all of that, they were marketed differently, and they were marketed better. They were presented not just to Jewish people, but to a broader base. You know, we think of New York, and Lenny Bruce said, whether you're Jewish or not, if you live in New York, you're Jewish. Okay. And the truth of the matter is that because New York does represent so many different groups, and we have all happily blended together in this wonderful melting pot, our food choices have crossed cultural lines. And I think the delicatessen was really instrumental in popularizing those foods. And they presented them in a way that was accessible, felt familiar even to non-Jewish people. You take corned beef, for instance. As many Irish people in New York bought corned beef from kosher butchers as Jewish people, because they felt it was the best quality meat, and that's where they purchased their corned beef. So you now had, you know, an Irish family going to a, what we would call at the time, a Jewish delicatessen, and they would order a corned beef sandwich. And so now it's no longer a Jewish food. Now it's an Irish food in a Jewish delicatessen. So once you have factors like that, where you have a delicatessen doing a good job of presenting food ways that cross cultural boundaries, I think you help them to integrate more seamlessly into their food culture, and thereby they adopt them, and the Jewishness sort of begins to fade away, and it becomes associated with a locale rather than a religion or an immigrant group. It just mm-hmm. becomes the food that you're just used to seeing. Black and white cookies, there is nothing inherently Jewish about a black and white cookie. Actually, it wasn't even started by a Jewish bakery. It started at a bakery in Utica, New York, called Hemstrotz, who made a cookie they called the Half Moon, half chocolate, half vanilla. And somehow it migrated downstate. It ended up in, among other bakeries, in Glazier's Bake Shop on the Upper East Side. In that area of New York City, you had a lot of immigrants, both Jewish and German Jewish, and also just straight out German. And they, again, together, they decided this is a delicious cookie. And it became thought of as a Jewish cookie because there were a lot of Jewish people on the Upper East Side in that little area, but there was nothing inherently Jewish about it. So now you had bakeries such as Ohrwasher's, and then William Greenberg, and of course Zarrow's Family Bakery,
right,
who I think has elevated that cookie to a stature that we hadn't seen before, and has now brought it to a much broader community. Well, it's no longer associated as a Jewish cookie. When it was featured on Seinfeld alongside babka, I don't think people in Nebraska realized that you know, Larry David was calling out a Jewish baked good. They just saw this as an American New York bakery product. And oh, when I come to New York, I'm definitely getting a slice of babka, a half a pound of rugelach, and a black and white cookie, because
right,
that's New York food.
And you just kind of brought to mind also, I mean, there are Jewish food tours for people when they come to visit New York, which is, you know, it's wonderful. And you said that these were not Jewish foods, but popularized in Jewish restaurants. And of course, once again, in the delis. And, you know, what's for dessert? Well, we have a black and white cookie. We have a cheesecake. We have babka. These, and a lot of the food terms are actually Yiddish words with the actual meaning of something that then inspired the name of the dish, correct?
Yes. I mean, my favorite would probably be anybody who grew up with a parent who spoke Yiddish, and certainly a grandparent who was who immigrated here, had to learn a little bit of Yiddish in order to know what they were being discussed at the dinner table. And so in my home, that was absolutely true. And my mother would turn to me every now and again if I did something she didn't love, and she'd say, "Oh, for gosh sakes, you're taking my kishkas out." Now, kishka, it literally translates from Yiddish to mean intestine. Yum. Doesn't that sound appetizing? But kishka is a Jewish food that has now probably a better PR agent said, let's stop calling it that. It never caught on, possibly because it had this off-putting name, and it's now called stuffed derma. And right, it is still available in most authentic delicatessens. But kishka means intestine, because back in the day, it was basically just a stuffing, and it was stuffed into a lining of the animal, and it was the intestinal lining. It's not the way it's made now, but yes, that's what kishka means. Right. So a lot of the terms really have a true meaning. The word bagel comes from a word bagan, and that translates to mean to bend. And so you look at it and you say, okay, that makes sense. You had to form a circle. You bent the dough. And again, I'll go back to loopholes. Do you know why bagels are made the way bagels are made?
You're going to tell me.
I am going to tell you. This is what I do when I go to a dinner with friends, and they unfortunately bring up something, and I go, do you want to know why? But happily, your listeners hopefully do. So the reason that a bagel is prepared the way it is, unlike some of its cousins, like the tarali, which is, you'll see them even today in an Italian delicatessen. They're these delicious little circular crunchy bites. They look like mini, mini, mini bagels, and they're very often seasoned with anise or fennel. That was baked. Jewish people were, again, forbidden from baking food in medieval times. And that carried forth into the mid-17, 1800s. And the church forbade Jewish people from baking. But they wanted to bring forward with them the pretzel that they would eat in Germany. So what did they do? They morphed these two things. They made it circular, and they boiled it. And by boiling it, which is what makes a bagel, by boiling it before baking it, they found that loophole, and they were allowed to produce that product.
And that's, and it, what I love is that you even have a recipe for bagels in the beginning of the
book.
Well,
there is a bagel chip recipe in the book, because I feel that here's my bagel advice in a nutshell. If you walk into a bagel store and it doesn't smell yeasty, it's not an authentic bagel shop. If you walk into a bagel shop and they suggest you toast the bagel, it's not a fresh bagel. Okay? So those are two of the things. But what you can do with that leftover bagel, you can either toast it. And when you toast a bagel, you always put butter on it. It's the only time you butter a bagel, just so you know. It's not a law. It's a convention. You toast a bagel, you butter it. A fresh bagel, you smear it with cream cheese. But if you take that day-old bagel, it's really not good for much other than a baby to teeth on or a hockey puck. But if you cut it into these thin little pieces and you toss it with a little olive oil and some sea salt, you have created fabulous bagel chips at a fraction of what it costs to buy. And then you get that essence of the everything bagel by taking a little bit of sour cream and cream cheese and mixing it with spices or go to Trader Joe's and buy their everything bagel seasoning, and you've now made yourself a little appetizer that you can eat really all week long. And it's a real cheat and saves you a lot of money and utilizes those ingredients that you might have just sitting around and going to waste. There are recipes like that in the book. They're all relatively practical. They are slight reinventions without losing the essence of the heritage and the original food story.
Right. And huge industry developed around these things too.
Oh. But
what I wanted to talk about, you started out with it talking about Kishka. Now, I kind of call them the K words, the K food. And they're the ones that perhaps didn't become as iconic across the country, except of course within the, you know, the Jewish culture. And perhaps it was because, as you said, because they continued to hold that K word, the K name or the whatever. Knish, of course, is forget that. That is, you know, that remains iconic. And Kugel. Mm-hmm. Kreplach.
Right. Kreplach, kasher varnishkas. For whatever reason, and I do think it's all in the selling. What's a kreplach? It's a wonton that speaks Yiddish. That's a kreplach. It's the same food. But we all know what wontons are. I would wager to guess that unless you grew up in a Jewish home, you probably don't know what a kreplach is. Mm-hmm. It certainly doesn't sound appetizing or appealing, but it's a delicious little, you know, triangle or pouch of thin dough that is stuffed with, not pork, of course, but with a chicken and possibly scallions and other ingredients that make it really savory and delicious and a fabulous complement to a bowl of chicken soup. Matzo balls, everybody knows.
A dumpling, right?
Yeah, right. Now, you know, matzo balls, why did that catch on? It's hard to know, but it did. Maybe because matzo became something that people saw on the shelves at their supermarkets, and so it was a word that became familiar to more people. Kasher varnishkas, I laugh. You could walk into a trendy, Upper West Side restaurant and see on their menu, you know, toasted buckwheat groats with caramelized onions.
Right.
And, you know, they're charging an exorbitant amount for it. And I look at that listing and I laugh and I say, well, that's kasher varnishkas. Again, not a dish that is readily familiar, but when I wrote Recipes Remembered, it was one that I became incredibly familiar with from my Holocaust survivors. And I will tell anyone out there who wants to make it, not for Passover, because obviously the noodles are not Pesedik, but if you do make it for just a weeknight meal one day, make sure you crack an egg into those buckwheat groats while you toast them, because that's what adds all the texture and brings out the nuttiness in in the actual kasha.
Why is it the bow tie noodle that's so popular in that dish?
I can't possibly understand that, because they never cook fully through in the center of that bow tie. Yeah. To me, in order to get a perfect farfalle, and again, if we're going to be very highbrow, kasher varnishkas is, you know, buckwheat groats and bow tie pasta, but it's a farfalle noodle. It's a very Italian noodle, and I always feel that the center remains just a little bit toothsome. It's a little too al dente for my taste, but it is always that that noodle, and you've given me something that now I'm going to want to research. Or if any of your listeners have the answer, email me. You know where to find me.
Right. Well, this is just, I mean, these and so many other great foods, it just... and I'm glad that you brought up black and white cookies, because again, it's a New York food. It's not a Jewish food, but it's so hard to separate the two sometimes, mm-hmm. I love that people think of New York and think of all these special foods. It is what makes New York special. Just like, you know, you can come to New York and find just about any ethnic food from, you know, all over the world here. And these foods, of course, have just taken root in New York and popularized throughout the country, if not, you know, throughout the world.
without question. And I do love also one of the nice things that's happening, and it's not a new thing, but it's something that I think is on everyone's radar, is that it's not just Jewish people who produce Jewish food, or as we want to call it, New York food.
Right.
One of the best bagels in the city comes from Absolute Bagels. It's owned and run by a Thai gentleman. One of the most delicious brisket sandwiches that you can get is from David's Brisket House. They're a Yemenite family. What is so special about the foods that came of age in New York, especially during that period of time, whether they were Jewish foods or foods representative of other ethnic groups, is they were embraced by a diverse culture. It's one of the things that makes New York, New York. And because of it, you could get in a taxi cab and in the fall, in September, and trust me, that Sikh cab driver knows when Rosh Hashanah begins. New York is such an interesting combination, because while everyone is very strong to identify and hold on to their heritage, we are also generous in wanting to share and absorb each other's cultures and traditions. It's one of the things that makes New York as special as it is, and especially for somebody who loves food history and really loves celebrating the food, not just of my culture, but of all cultures, and preserving food memory by telling their stories. It's communicated every day in New York throughout the food business, the way we handle food and the way we approach food.
Well said. That's why I identified you up front as a New Yorker.
a very proud New Yorker. Thank you.
Well, June, thank you so much for sharing all this. And truly, these stories are just the tip of the iceberg, folks. So,
thank you. If you want to learn about the hot dog wars on Coney Island, or why Eleanor Roosevelt started a political phenomena with the Knish, I've got those stories to share with you. So I hope your readers, your listeners will become readers and hunger for more.
That's good. So it is, again, the book is Iconic New York Jewish Food, A History and Guide with Recipes. And June Hirsch, the author, has been my guest. And this has been another Taste of the Past. A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio, or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.